I think we'll have an interesting few studies coming up. They're all kind of related to each other. What I want to look at tonight is the I am statements in the signs that John lays out, and the relationship between the I am statements and the signs. I had really throughout the week really racked my brain on what's the best way to lay out the theme of the book of John. And I really think that Dr. Bullinger hit the nail on the head on how the best way to understand John, and that's through the signs that are given in the book of John. If we can understand the relationship that those signs have with the I am statements, and we can understand the relationship that the signs have with each other, I think we'll come away with a really good understanding of the entire book of John. I think John really has a main theme that it really tries to hammer home. And everything that John records is going to point to that theme. And these things are laid out because they are indicative of hitting that theme and taking us to that end conclusion. And I know a number of years back I had done a study on the signs and how they related, and that's why I was really racking my brain to see is there something I could do that would maybe give an understanding without kind of rehashing some things I had done a number of years ago. Hopefully I've learned a lot since then and can add to it in that regard. But really, I think that is the way to understand this book, is through these signs and the I am statement. Now, before we really get going, I want to mention there's 7 I am statements. Now, what's 7 the number of? Completeness. Okay, so the I am statements is going to give us a complete picture of who Messiah is. And then there's 8 signs that John is going to lay out. Now, what's 8 the number of? A new beginning. Okay? I've heard some commentators say it's a new beginning because it speaks of regeneration. And I like that idea. New beginning equals regeneration. And we'll look at it in that sense. Now, before we get going, I want to talk about the signs for a moment, just in general. The signs are really going to be laid out in 4 distinct parts. It's going to be a 2-3-2-1 layout. Okay? 2-3-2-1. The first 2 signs are going to be given during the first phase of Jesus' ministry. And those first 2 signs are during the proclamation of the government or the kingdom that's coming. That would be phase 1 of Jesus' ministry. So the first 2 signs, that would be the wedding feast and the royal official's son being healed. That's phase 1 of Jesus' ministry. The next 3 signs are during the manifestation of his person, of he himself. He's revealing himself, not just to his apostles, but to the nation. That would be the second phase of Jesus' ministry, that presentation of himself. That would begin with the healing of the man at the pool of Bethesda. Then it would go to the feeding of the 5,000. And then it would include him walking on the water shortly after the feeding of the 5,000. Ironically, it's at that point that Luke records they wanted to make him Messiah. They wanted to make him king at that point.
Cool. Yep. Feeding the 5,000.
Yep.
Yeah.
Walking on water. Okay, then phase three, which would be the next two, would be during the rejection of his government and of him. So it's the rejection period, phase three of Jesus' ministry. That would be the healing of the blind man born blind and the raising of Lazarus. And then the last one, which is the fourth phase of Jesus' ministry, it would be his post-resurrection ministry. And that's the miraculous catch of fishes. And really, that's going to really speak to the future regathering of Israel by the rejected Messiah. So it's going to speak of regeneration. Okay. Oh, those are the eight signs of what we're going to say, John.
So it's just the one sign in phase four, which is the miraculous fish catch, speaking of the regeneration of Israel.
Right, and the regathering of the nation. So,
okay.
Yeah.
Well, we don't know what the significance of 153 is, do we?
No. I think the idea with that is it's just a number to convey it was a lot.
Thank you. They were great fishes, not average fishes.
Not average.
Big fish.
Yeah. So the other thing, and we'll look at this over the upcoming weeks, and I've talked on it before, and I know Dr. Bullinger has some really good notes on it as well in his companion Bible. That sign one, the wedding feast, will go with the miraculous catch of fishes, the eighth sign.
Mm-hmm.
The second sign will go with the seventh, the third with the sixth, and the fourth with the fifth. They're kind of in groups of two there. So, having said all that, let's go to John chapter 1 for a second. John chapter 1. Now, this is going to be John the Baptist speaking here. Let's start at verse 30, and we'll read from verse 30 down through verse 34. Okay? This is the one about whom I said, after me comes a man who ranks above me, because he existed before me. I did not recognize him, but I came baptizing with water so that he might be revealed to Israel. Then testified, I saw the Spirit descending like a dove from heaven, and it remained on him. And I did not recognize him, but the one who sent me to baptize with water said to me, the one on whom you see the Spirit descending and remaining, this is the one who baptizes with the Holy Spirit. And I saw and testified that this is the Son of Elohim. Now, the reason I bring this up is verse 31 really is the main point of chapter 1 going through a lot of things that John goes through. Now, notice what it says. I did not recognize him, speaking of Jesus, but I came baptizing with water so that he, speaking of the Messiah, might be revealed to Israel. In other words, the whole purpose of the book of John even is that Jesus would be revealed to Israel. And John mentions that he came baptizing with water, and the whole reason he came to baptize with water was to reveal the Messiah to the nation. Now, he says later on, in verse 34, 33, he describes the point when he had the aha moment. Okay? Verse 34, he sees Jesus in a new light. It's not that he didn't recognize him, it's his cousin. He recognized who he was. He didn't recognize him as the Messiah.
Right.
But in verse 34, he sees him, recognizes him, and begins to proclaim it. Right? And it's interesting, in verse 35, coming on the heels of that, the next day John was standing there again with two of his disciples. As he watched Jesus walk by, he said, "Look, the Lamb of Elohim." So now John begins to elaborate. He understands, I believe, that he's the high priest of Israel, and he is identifying the Lamb that is going to be sacrificed for Israel. He's already identified. Why? He knows who he is. And the rest of the book is going to lay out Jesus so that Israel can recognize who their Messiah is. It's the purpose on John's writing. In fact, he even says it elsewhere, that by writing you might know that Jesus is the Christ, or is the Messiah. So, let's look at how he does this with the relationship of the I Am statements and the different signs. Let's go there. The first miracle is the wedding feast in chapter 2. If you want to turn to chapter 2. And we can read, well, it's 12 verses, but yeah, I guess we could read through the 12 verses. I'll read verse 1 and we can kind of read around the room. And on the third day, a marriage took place in Cana of Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there.
And both Jesus was called and his disciples to the marriage.
And when they wanted wine, mother Jesus said, "They have no wine." Jesus saith unto her, "Woman, what have I to do with thee? Mine hour cannot yet come."
Oh, and his mother said unto his servant, "Whatever he says you unto you, do it."
Six stone water jars were there. They were used for Jewish purification rituals. Each jar held 20 to 30 gallons.
And Jesus says to them, "Fill the water pots with water." And they filled them up to the brim.
And he said to them, "Draw out now, and bear unto the governor of the feast, and they bear it. When the ruler of the feast has tasted the water that was made wine, and knew not whence it was,
I said unto him, "Every man at the beginning does set forth good wine, and when men have well drunk, then that which is the worse. But you have kept the good wine until now."
Thus the first sign of Jesus wrought at Cana in Galilee, by which he displayed his power, and his disciples believed into him.
After this he went down to Capernaum, he and his mother and his brethren and his disciples. They continued there not many days.
Okay, so interestingly enough, John here is going to tell us this is his first sign. He wants us to get the point. And it's dealing with the idea of a wedding feast. Right? Now, and not only is it dealing with the idea of a wedding feast, but it's dealing with wine itself, a beverage that comes from vines, grapevines, right? Now, there's a whole lot of typology in this that we could get into. You know, who's the bridegroom, who's the bride, you know, all of this. I don't want to talk on that tonight. I want you to keep that in the back of your mind because we will come back and we will look at that. That's not the purpose for tonight, though. Okay? The whole point here, and there's a couple of points. One, we see that Jesus is there with his mother. And in verse 4, for instance, a lot of people think that Jesus is kind of rude to his mother, a I've heard a lot of people say that, but they just don't understand the way that Jesus is talking. Typically, he does refer to his mother as woman from this point out in Scripture. Now, I think that's significant because I think it's showing a change in the relationship between the two. There's a change. She's no longer a care provider for a child. The relationship has changed, and she's now the inferior. Okay, that's point one. The second point there is when he says, what have I to do with you, or what is that to me and to you? That's a way that they would talk in Hebrew. Now, the Greek does a very good job of bringing that into the Greek, and they've done a good job of bringing that into English, translating it word for word. It literally means the idea of, it has a twofold idea. Well, how does that concern us? What is that to you and me? How does that concern you and I? The other way is more of a negative, and that's basically, that's their problem. Right? That would be an idiom for either of those statements. Based off of the responses, we can eliminate that their problem from the equation. Jesus does respond in kind. So basically, well, you know, what's the difference for you and I is sort of the idea that he's conveying. And he says why in the context, because his hour has not yet come. Now, there's a lot of commentators that try to give you an understanding of what it means by my hour has not yet come. But what that always means when Jesus says that phrase everywhere is his death. Every time Jesus uses that phrase, my hour has not yet come, it's a reference to him being put to death. Everywhere you read it in the Gospels, that's where what he's referencing. The idea here, being a wedding feast, is it's joining together a bride and a groom. And they're coming together and having a celebration. And I think what Jesus is giving us an insight into here is that by performing this miracle, what he's saying is, my hour is not yet come, so I can't be enjoined to Israel yet. I think that's what he's trying to convey here. Now, it goes over their head. They don't know what he's talking about. The other thing that we can assume, I think safely assume here, it doesn't say it outright, but I think it's implied in the passage. Jesus is there. A number of his disciples are there. Mary's there. Now, I'm going to guess that the disciples that are there are the ones that are related to him, which are, you know, one, six, stab.
James, John, Jude.
Jude is... Jude wouldn't be a believer yet, though.
No.
But James and John, in particular. Okay? So, I think we can be safe to assume that it's somebody that's close to the family. Right? Especially when it talks to the very next passages after it, that the Passover is near and brings up all of his family. The other thing is it's taking place in Cana, which is in Galilee, and Galilee is the base of operations where Jesus is going to work out of. he makes reference to the six stone water jars or jugs, right? They're used for the purification rituals, for cleansing. So you have the idea of cleansing, purification, and the number six. Six is the number of what?
Man.
Okay, so the idea of purifying man is being conveyed here. Now, does is he changes the water into wine. Now that's an interesting thing. He takes what would be a sorrowful moment and turns it into one of great joy. Right? Now, let me go to another passage and then we'll tie it in. If you go to John 15, John 15, 3 verses 1 through, let's go 1 through 1. I am the true vine, and my Father is the vine dresser.
Every branch in me that bears not fruit, he takes away. And every branch that bears fruit, he purges it, that it may bring forth more fruit.
Now you are clean through the word which I have spoken to you. Abide in me, and I in you. The branch cannot bear fruit of itself, except it abide in the vine. No more can ye, except ye abide in me.
I am the vine. You are the branches. He that abides in me, and I in him, the same brings forth much fruit. For without me, you can do nothing.
If a man does not remain in me, he is thrown out as a branch and is withered. And they gather them, throw them into the fire, and they are burned.
If you abide in me, and my words abide in you, you shall ask what you will, and it shall be done for you.
Herein is my Father glorified, that you hear much truth, which so shall redeem my disciples. As the Father has loved me, so have I loved you. Continue ye in my love.
If you keep my commandments, you shall abide in my love, even as I have kept my Father's commandments and abide in his love.
Now, we could go down, I guess, to verse 14. These things I have spoken to you, that my joy might remain in you, and your joy might be complete.
This is my commandment, that you love one another as I have loved you.
Greater love hath no man than this, that a man lay down his life for his friends. Ye are my friends, if ye do whatsoever I command you.
You could read 15.
Okay. Henceforth I call you not servants, for the servant knows not what his Lord does. But I have called you friends, for all things that I have heard of my Father, I have made known unto you.
Okay, so here we have one of the I am statements. I am the true vine. Now, it's interesting because a vine, you get grapes from a vine. Grapes are made into wine, right? We know the idea. Jesus here is elaborating some things, though. Verse 2 is an interesting one. And in verse 2, the King James says something a little bit different than what this rendering says. I want to go to the note here, because I think this catches the sense better than the King James. Verse 2, every branch in me not bearing fruit, he props up. And each one bearing fruit, he prunes, so that it may bear more fruit. Now, the footnote here says this. The Greek verb aero, A-I-R-O, can mean to lift up, as well as to take away. It can be understood here as a reference to the vine dresser lifting up a weak branch to give it a chance to bear fruit again. Now, he goes through that after he's done that, if it continues to not bear fruit, then it's broken off and burned. But the first phase of it is it has to be given the chance to bear fruit. And I think prop up catches the sense better of what Jesus' ministry was all about. He didn't come in the minute somebody didn't believe him, stop stop talking to them and go to somebody else. He continued to minister and propped them up until they outright rejected him over and over again. So the idea is that he's propping them up. He is the true vine, and his father is the vine dresser. Now, interestingly enough, back there in John chapter 2, you want to go there for a second. John 2. And in John 2, let's read verse 9. When the man in charge of the feast tasted the water that had become wine without knowing where it had come from, through the servants who had drawn the water, though the servants who had drawn the water knew, he called for the bridegroom. Now, the whole key here is that there's one who's in charge of this wine, of getting it and putting on this feast, right? Jesus is here saying back in John 15 that he's the vine, but there's one who's in charge of the pruning. That one who's in charge of the pruning isn't him. It's the Father. He's the vine dresser. Now, this all goes back into the typology back in Isaiah when he talks about the vine. And he goes through that analogy of that parable in Isaiah of the vine. And he gets into that. The idea here that he's getting at is that in John 2, when a grape is squeezed and the juice comes out, people refer to that as wine, juice, but it has another name. It's called the blood of the grape. It's a terminology a lot of wineries will use. The blood of the grape. The idea here, I think, that's being conveyed in John 2 at the wedding of Cana is there's wine that's being produced, but it's not of the highest quality. In other words, there's the blood of a grape, but it's not the highest of quality. Jesus performs this miracle, changes water into wine, and it's of the highest grade wine. I think it's symbolic, and what he's getting at here is that first thing is indicative of Israel's sacrificial system with the animals. The sacrifice of those animals and their shedding of blood, it covered, and it was sufficient for a time. But there's a point when that coverage runs out. And now Jesus provides a different offering. But his blood doesn't run out. That's right. Yeah, it's a used for purification rituals, right? The idea is that he's the source of purification. All of that is being spoken of. Now, the whole point is that grape is attached to the vine. Right? In John 15, when John identifies Jesus as that true vine, I am the true vine, the idea here is it's a reference to the nation and the nation being grafted in, being brought into him. It's a statement that oftentimes is used over and over again in the Old Testament where Israel is referenced as a vine. For instance, I have a footnote here, and it says there are numerous Old Testament passages which refer to Israel as a vine. I'm going to give you a few. Psalm 80, verses 8 through 16. the most well-known out of them, Isaiah 5, verses 1 through 7, Jeremiah 2, verse 21, Ezekiel 15, verses 1 through 8, Ezekiel 17, verses 5 through 10, Ezekiel 19, verses 10 through 14, and Hosea 10:1. The vine became symbolic of Israel and even appeared on some coins issued by the Maccabees. Well, that's interesting.
Oh, the door, the temple carved into the door. So.
Yeah. Yeah. Old Testament passages which use this symbol appear to regard Israel as faithless to Yahweh and to the object of severe punishment. It's Ezekiel's thrust in chapter 15 in particular.
Right.
Ezekiel 15, 1 through 8 in particular, talks about the worthlessness of wood from a vine in relation to disobedient Judah. A branch cut from a vine is worthless except to be burned as fuel. This fits with the statements about the disciples who aren't going to cling to Jesus and what he's saying. The whole point that he's getting at is they have to be grafted into him. Now this gives a whole new understanding, I think, to Romans 11, too. Romans 11, we have to understand, is the dispensational part of the book of Romans. And he's talking about Israel in Romans 11. The body of Christ is not in Romans 11. He's talking about believing Israel and unbelieving Israel. And he's talking about the unbelieving part of Israel having the opportunity to be grafted back in. You don't take something that's not a vine, a vine by nature, and graft it into a vine. It's not going to grow. I don't take, say, something from one type of a plant and put it into another type of plant and expect it to sprout. That's not the point. The point is he's taking something that's the same kind. Believing and unbelieving still is of the same kind. The whole context of Romans 11 is that all Israel shall be saved, right? So we have to begin to think of these things and to begin to understand them. By the way, the olive, I've heard it over and over again, is symbolic of what? What do you typically hear olive is used to represent?
Peace.
What else?
Olive oil.
If you're talking in relationship to Israel, what does the olive tree typically symbolize?
Spiritual Israel.
Right. The idea with the olive, though, is it also embodies the idea of light. Right. Back in the Old Testament, you're going to read passages of the olive oil producing light. Now, with all that understanding, it kind of has to play into how you understand Romans 11. Now, the whole idea is Jesus is saying he is the vine. Israel begins with me. And you have to be brought into me in order to have life. How are you brought into me? Through the blood of the vine that you have to partake of. Well, the blood of the vine, if he's the vine, it would be his blood. It's the wedding feast at Cana that speaks of that. These two things together collectively are giving us the picture of how that marriage ceremony is going to work in the future. It's a number of people. For instance, Paul says in Romans 9 through 11, not all Israel is of Israel. In other words, just because they're a direct descendant of Abraham and they have a circumcision in their flesh doesn't mean that they're part of that regenerated nation. Not all of them will be. Some of them are going to miss out on the millennium. Why? Because they will not have life in this eon.
Or the one
to come, right? some of them are going to miss that. Not all
being in Washington, D.C.
That's right.
They missed out.
Because they missed out. So not all of Israel's direct descendants are going to be partakers of that. Okay, that's the whole point. So I think when we begin to see this relationship of these, of the statement, I am the true vine, and the wedding feast at Cana, the two just naturally go together. I think it's pretty clear. And what you have is when he says that I am statement, he's building off of material that they already understand. There's a lot of things in the Old Testament that's elaborated about Israel being the vine. He's talking about himself being the true vine. And he's already elaborated some things through his miracle on Israel being enjoined into him. So I think you know that's where I want to leave that. Now, any questions on that? Does it make sense? Okay. I think to me this is exciting material. Now, I don't know. Sometimes I'm a little weird and I get excited about things that people find cut and dry. But
no, it is exciting. There's some other analogies, like you said. There's a lot of other analogies.
There is. You know, and when you start getting into the type, like the friend of the bridegroom,
mm-hmm.
you know, and really that would be telling us a lot about.
And just like that, in verse 9, it would, the ruler of the feast,
mm-hmm.
you would, you know, from the analogy of John 15, you would make an assumption that would be the father.
That's right.
Because the father is the one that has, in the analogy of the marriage in a Jewish wedding, that's what happens. The father is the one that throws the feast.
That's right.
The wedding feast lasts 4 or 7 days, and that's why there's a lot of wine. That's why he had this 20 to 30 gallons of wine.
Right.
But there's a little funny thing there that he tasted the water that was made wine and he knew not where it was from.
Yeah, he didn't know. So there's a lot of fascinating things when you begin to look at that.
Yeah, but then after...
Well, I mean, all types break down at some point.
After it, the governor of the feast calls the bridegroom. So that's when the actual celebration takes place, when the bridegroom comes out of the bridal chamber.
Right. It's fascinating when you begin to look at those things.
With the bridegroom. Bridegroom will be Christ.
Yeah.
So the bridegroom is the one responsible for supplying the wine, which is for the type here. And the governor of the feast should be the father.
Mm-hmm.
Father surprised by.
Well, again, you always have every type breaks down at some point, though.
If he doesn't, maybe there's something really there that is.
Yeah.
Maybe just like Jesus says that. Of that day, knows no man except the Father.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a few things that except the host, the Father.
And that's possible. That's possible. You know, that's something that most of us just never consider.
What Father saying? I didn't see that coming.
Well, for instance, we can look at it and say that Yahweh, in the Old Testament, there were times he was caught totally by surprise and didn't see something coming.
Mm-hmm.
One that I always think of is in the book of Jeremiah, when Jeremiah records for us that Israel was sacrificing children to Moloch, and Yahweh says it never entered my mind,
mm-hmm.
nor my thoughts,
right,
that they would do such a thing.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a case in point where he's caught totally by surprise.
Mm-hmm. You're doing a lot.
You know, I think that's a great verse, by the way, to show the openness of God.
Yeah.
You know, that was one, though. They're doing, what? How could they do this? It never entered his mind. Which then should cause people that believe in the idea of God eternally tormenting somebody with fire. If it never entered God's mind that such a thing would be done, why would we think that God was planning to do that? I mean, the light should go on there. But, you know, that's just the way people are.
People used to read
Paul Harvey would say. The next I am statement I want to look at is in chapter 14 of John, in verse 6. And it's interesting. Let me start before we get to 6. Verse 1. Do not let your hearts be distressed. You believe in Elohim, believe also in me. There are many dwelling places in my Father's house. If not, I would have told you, because I am going away to make ready a place for you. And if I go and prepare a place for you, I am coming again and will receive you to myself, so that where I am, you may be also. And you know the way where I am going. Thomas said to him, Adonai, we do not know where you go, so how can we be knowing the way? I am the way, replied Jesus, and the truth and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. If you have known me, you will know my Father too. And from now on, you do know him and have seen him. Now, I'm going to stop there. There's a lot of ramifications to all of those things. This, by the way, is one of the verses that people that hold to the modalistic view of thinking about God would use this passage to show that view. And it's a very strong verse to show that view. And I think it's a great verse for them to use, to show that view. I would too, by the way, use that verse. Now, here,
you mean
if I held that view, this would be a verse I would go to, a passage I would go to show the modalist view. The whole point that we're getting at here, and this is talking. There's a dispensational element to this. I know a lot of people use this at funerals. A lot of people use this, to try to give comfort and things like that. It's not talking about what they're trying to make it talk about. It's, again, talking about a Jewish wedding and building the bridal chamber. The King James renders it as mansions. Literally, it should be dwelling places or dwelling chambers might even be a better way to render it.
Like Assyria?
I'm sorry?
Like Assyria?
Yes. That idea. It's something in the Septuagint. The word is used constantly in Ezekiel chapters 40 through 48. And in Ezekiel 40 through 48, there's a vivid description that's going to be given of the temple and the living quarters within the temple. Those living quarters within the temple is the same phrase. Now, the idea he's getting at is, again, talking in Jewish wedding. The father is the one who appoints the time when the wedding would take place, and it's based off of the idea of the son building a bridal chamber for him and his bride to live in, and the father giving the stamp of approval that it's good enough for them to do it. It prevents the person from just putting up any old shack that's not worthy of living in. It's going to guarantee that it's something that's sturdy and sound and is livable. The thing about it, too, is that the marriages would have what they call the espousal time frame. During that espousal time frame, the idea would be that they would be away building this chamber. They would go away and build the bridal chamber and really not have a lot of contact with the bride, right, until the big moment arrives. Now, that's kind of what John was alluding to in John 2, where the son is presented by the father, right? He comes out and he's presented. So you have all this going on. Now, Jesus is alluding to all of that And he says he's going away and that they know the way. And Thomas, you got to love Thomas. There's a little bit of him in all of us, I think, right? We all kind of scratch our head at times and really don't get it. But Thomas goes, well, how can you say we know the way when we don't know the way, right? And Jesus goes, I am the way. I am the truth and the life. Now, the idea is that Jesus is the only way into this chamber that he's building. The chamber would be a new temple that would come down from heaven. That's what Revelation alludes to. And the chambers would be there for his bride to fill. Now, this is going to coincide with something that on the surface doesn't seem to fit. But give me a chance to explain it, and you'll see it does. Go to John 4. And in John 4, let's look at verses 45 down through the end of the chapter, 54. We can read it around the room again. Verse 40. So when he came to Galilee, the Galileans welcomed him because they had seen all the things he had done in Jerusalem at the feast, for they themselves had gone to the feast.
So Jesus came again into Cana of Galilee, where he made the water wine. And there was a certain nobleman whose son was sick at Capernaum.
When he heard that Jesus was come out of Judea into Galilee, he went into him, and he thought that he would come down and heal the son, but he was at the point of death.
Then said Jesus unto them, except these signs and wonders, you will not believe.
The nobleman said unto him, Sir, come down, or else my son, my child, dies.
Jesus is saying to him, Go, your son is living. And the man believes the word which Jesus said to him and went his way.
And he was now going down. His servants met him and told him, saying, Your son lives.
Then inquired he of them the hour when he began to amend. And they said unto him, Yesterday at the seventh hour the fever left him.
So the father knew that it was at the same hour in the which Jesus said unto him, My son lives, and himself believes.
This is again the second miracle that Jesus did when he was come out of Judea into Galilee.
Okay, so John is being specific. It's the second sign, second miracle.
Yeah.
He's going to give us the sequence so that from everyone that follows here on out, we know to count them sequentially.
Okay.
He's not going to have to continue to do it, but first, second, the analogy is, okay, this is the third, and so on. John is very specific. He doesn't go into recording all these miracles like some of the other books do. He pinpoints certain ones. Now, the idea here is that there's this official from Capernaum. Now, Capernaum is, by the way, where Jesus goes and basically lives in Capernaum, right? But he's back in Cana, which is in Galilee. The place of his first son. And there's a man who comes to him whose son is sick. Now, I want you to stop and think about this for a second. Where is Galilee, if you hit a map? Would it be in Israel or Judah?
Israel.
It's in Israel.
Northern.
So it's in northern... The northern 10 tribes, right? Was Israel sick?
Yes.
Were they on the point of death?
Oh, yeah.
If not already dead? Right? Do they need to be healed?
Sure.
Okay. And this is the point that he's trying to make here. The first point, he has the marriage feast in Cana. He comes back to Cana. Now, Now, the only way that they can be enjoined to him is if they're healed from what prevents them from being joined to him. They have a disease. The disease is called sin. Actually, the big disease is called idolatry. Right? Oftentimes, Scripture calls that sin, from God's perspective with Israel, adultery. They're an adulterous nation. In fact, Jesus even calls them that. And they're blind. That's a different issue that we'll get to, right? They're at the point of death. In other words, they're at the point of ceasing to exist. Why do I say that? Because they are so far gone from God that even their religious system is totally corrupt. Now, it's funny because all of this comes on the heels, by the way, of him having talked to the woman at the well, you know, and so on. You have a lot of the Samaritans coming into belief based off of that. The whole point he's getting at is that Israel is sick. They're at the point of death. And they need life. What does Jesus do? He speaks a word which causes a miraculous healing, right? Now follow what it says here. Verse 49. Sir, the official said to him, come down before my child dies. Jesus is saying to him, go, your son is living. And the man believes the word which Jesus said to him and went his way. I think that's an interesting choice of words there too. While he was on his way, his slaves met him and told him that his child was alive. He then asked from them the hour in which he had gotten better. And they said to him, yesterday at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, the fever left him. It was clear then to the father that this was the very time at which Jesus said to him, your son is living. And he had faith in Jesus, he and all his family. Again, this second sign Jesus did coming from Judah into Galilee. Jesus said he is the way, the truth, and the life. No man cometh to the Father but by me. Then he goes on and talks about keeping his commandments, right? Now, remember Israel, God's commandments were his word to the nation of Israel. That word was life to the nation of Israel. If they responded to that word positively, God would give them blessings, and all the blessings would flow. Some of those blessings was physical health, by the way. And if they rejected that word, what would come?
Curses.
Some of those curses was physical ailments. Now, the point is, the man believes what Jesus said. He believed the words Jesus spoke. By believing those words, he then was set on a path, on a way that was life. It produced life. Why? Because he believed Jesus. His faith came into existence. What Jesus said produced healing, which produced faith, which produced life.
For Israel, it was disobedience.
It was disobedience. And part of the reason they disbelieved, I mean, there can be lots of reasons why they disbelieved. But the point is, disbelief produced doubt of what God said to be true. You really will see that in some detail in two books of the Old Testament. You'll see it a lot. In the book of Jeremiah, they just don't believe what Jeremiah is saying. They can't fathom that God would ever destroy the temple. It's a foreign idea to them. They can't fathom the idea that Yahweh would come and allow his temple to be destroyed. It'll never happen. The other book that conveys that idea is Ezekiel. Now, they're both writing about the same time frame. But Ezekiel's kind of an interesting one because he's been given this commission by God, and he's been told, you're not going to speak unless I'm telling you what to say. So Ezekiel doesn't say anything. He's silent until he has a message from God, and he says it word for word. Ezekiel isn't free to say whatever he wants to say, and Ezekiel doesn't engage in pleasantry conversation with people. It's very specific. You do not speak unless I am putting the words in your mouth, and then you will say them. It's a fascinating thing people don't realize about that. There's a lot of things that he does that's really uncomfortable, right? Like, for instance, laying on his side without getting up for almost a year. Picture that, if you will, bed sores and all those things. It's not being able to speak unless God's telling you the exact words you're going to speak. Yet, the people in Judah could not fathom that the words that Ezekiel and Jeremiah were speaking to them would come true because, well, if he's really the greatest of all gods, how can he let his own temple be destroyed? They couldn't fathom it. So there is that element of unbelief there.
The Philistines take the Ark of Covenant.
I know. Their own history should have told them he'd let it. But they can't fathom that. You know, what other god would let their temple be destroyed willingly? What other god would bring about the destruction of his own temple? You know, that was the other thing they couldn't get their head around. Yet, you know, what other god is going to tell you to submit to some foreign leader who has other gods? Become a vassal nation to them. But they couldn't fathom that. They also couldn't fathom the idea that God would follow through on the curses that would come. The main curse being that he would make them the tail and all the other nations the head. They couldn't fathom that because how can a God show his greatness if he allows all the other nations' gods to be placed ahead of him? That's their thinking. Mm-hmm. And they just couldn't grasp it. So the whole point was they needed to be healed of that terminal illness. It was producing ultimately death for them as a people. And what he said some words that produced life. But that word way, the word way is interesting. That can be translated a number of ways. No pun intended on my choice of words there. It can be translated as road, as highway, as path. For instance, in Psalms, when he talks about thy word is the light unto my path, it's just, in the Septuagint, it would be the same word translated here as way, road. It has that sort of an idea with it. Early Christians were often referred to as believers of the way. That's the way they were typically referred to. And in fact, if you ever read Josephus, he oftentimes would call Christians believers of the way. And he makes reference to the believers of the way. Now he's giving a history of Israel, and sometimes he speaks of believers of the way in kind of a mockery sort of a way. Derogatory, that's the word I was thinking of. But the whole point is, Jesus is the way. And this man understood that Jesus is the way. There's only one path to God. It's through Jesus. And that produces healing, healing from the sin affliction, that produces life. And hence, I am the way, the truth, and the life would go with this miracle. Jesus' words produce life. Why? Because the man came to the way and embraced the truth of Jesus' words, and they produced life. That's this miracle. So you have disease turning into health. This is important, and it takes place in Cana. Why? Because for Jesus to have the marriage to the bride has to be healthy enough to get married. I mean, think about that. It's common sense, right? You're not going to join himself to something that's sick and dying. He's going to be enjoined to something pure and spotless, and that's the idea.
Yeah, and the bride is in preparation.
Right, that's right. So that's the first two, and we'll pick up next week with the next group. Any questions on that, though? Does it make sense?
Definitely.
Everybody's quiet.
Oh, makes sense. Nothing to argue about.
Okay.
Without controversy, great.
I think it's fun to go through these things and see the relationship with them. At least to my mind. Okay. Well, we'll have to let you folks in Ohio know what day it'll be next week. It'll either be Tuesday or Thursday. We're just waiting to find out a little bit later on. Lillian has to go for a medical procedure, and it's either going to be Tuesday or Thursday, so obviously we want as many people as we can have here, so once we have that information, we can give you a definite day. So, I will let you know.
Well, thank you.